Chapter 5. Which the Malay coxswain of the harbor launch raised for me. There was nobody in the office except the clerks, writing in two industrious rows. But the head shipping master hopped down from his elevation, and hurried along on the thick mats, to meet me in the broad central passage. He had a Scottish name, but his complexion was of a rich olive hue, his short beard was jet black, and his eyes, also black, had a languishing expression. He asked confidentially, "You want to see him?" All lightness of spirit and body having departed from me at the touch of officialdom, I looked at the scribe without animation, and asked in my turn wearily, "What do you think? Is it any use? My goodness! He has asked for you twice today." This emphatic he was the supreme authority, the marine superintendent, the harbor master, a very great person in the eyes of every single quill driver in the room. But that was nothing to the opinion he had of his own greatness. Captain Ellis looked upon himself as a sort of divine, pagan, emanation, the deputy Neptune for the circumambient seas. If he did not actually rule the waves, he pretended to rule the fate of the mortals whose lives were cast upon the waters. This uplifting illusion made him inquisitorial and peremptory. And as his temperament was chilleric, there were fellows who were actually afraid of him. He was redoubtable, not in virtue of his office, but because of his unwarrantable assumptions. I had never had anything to do with him before. I said, "Colonel, no. He has asked for me twice. Then perhaps I had better go in." "You must. You must." The shipping master led the way with a mincing gait around the whole system of desks to a tall and important-looking door, which he opened with a deferential action of the arm. He stepped right in, but without letting go of the handle, and, after gazing reverently down the room for a while, beckoned me in by a silent jerk of the head. Then he slipped out at once, and shut the door after me most delicately. Three lofty windows gave on the harbor. There was nothing in them, but the dark blue sparkling sea, and the paler luminous blue of the sky. My eye caught in the depths and distances of these blue tones the white speck of some big ship just arrived, and about to anchor in the outer roadstead. A ship from home after perhaps 90 days at sea. There is something touching about a ship coming in from sea and folding her white wings for a rest. The next thing I saw was the top knot of silver hair surmounting Captain Ellis's smooth red face, which would have been apoplectic if it hadn't had such a fresh appearance. Our deputy Neptune had no beard on his chin, and there was no trident to be seen standing in a corner anywhere, like an umbrella. But his hand was holding a pen, the official pen, far mightier than the sword in making or marring the fortune of simple toiling men. He was looking over his shoulder at my advance. When I had come well within range, he saluted me by a nerve-shattering colon, "Where have you been all this time?" As it was no concern of his, I did not take the slightest notice of the shot. I said simply that I had heard there was a master needed for some vessel, and being a sailing ship man, I thought I would apply. ... he interrupted me. "Hi! Hang it! You are the right man for that job if there had been 20 others after it. But no fear of that. They are all afraid to catch hold. That's what's the matter." He was very irritated. I said innocently, "Colin, are they, sir? I wonder why?" "Why," he fumed. "Afraid of the sails. Afraid of a white crew. Too much trouble. Too much work. Too long out here. Easy life and deck chairs more their mark. Here I sit with the Consul General's cable before me, and the only man fit for the job, not to be found anywhere. I began to think you were funking it too." I haven't been long getting to the office," I remarked calmly. "You have a good name out here, though," he growled savagely without looking at me. "I am very glad to hear it from you, sir," I said. "Yes. But you are not on the spot when you are wanted. You know you weren't. That steward of yours wouldn't dare to neglect a message from this office. Where the devil did you hide yourself for the best part of the day?" I only smiled kindly down on him, and he seemed to recollect himself, and asked me to take a seat. He explained that the master of a British ship, having died in Bangkok, the consul general had cabled to him a request for a competent man to be sent out to take command. Apparently, in his mind, I was the man from the first, though for the looks of the thing the certificate I had addressed to the sailor's home was general. An agreement had already been prepared. He gave it to me to read, and when I handed it back to him with the remark that I accepted its terms, the deputy Neptune signed it, stamped it with his own exalted hand, folded it in four, it was a sheet of blue foolscap, and presented it to me, a gift of extraordinary potency, for, as I put it in my pocket, my head swam a little. "This is your appointment to the command," he said with a certain gravity. "An official appointment binding the owners to conditions which you have accepted. Now when will you be ready to go?" I said I would be ready that very day if necessary. He caught me at my word with great alacrity. The steamer Melita was leaving for Bangkok that evening about 7. He would request her captain officially to give me a passage and wait for me till 10 o'clock. Then he rose from his office chair, and I got up too. My head swam, there was no doubt about it, and I felt a certain heaviness of limbs, as if they had grown bigger since I had sat down on that chair. I made my bow. A subtle change in Captain Ellis's manner became perceptible, as though he had laid aside the trident of Deputy Neptune. In reality, it was only his official pen that he had dropped on getting up. 2. He shook hands with me. "Well, there you are, on your own, appointed officially under my responsibility." He was actually walking with me to the door. What a distance off it seemed. I moved like a man in bonds. But we reached it at last. I opened it with the sensation of dealing with mere dream stuff, and then at the last moment the fellowship of seamen asserted itself, stronger than the difference of age and station. It asserted itself in Captain Ellis's voice. "Goodbye and good luck to you," he said so heartily that I could only give him a grateful glance. Then I turned and went out, never to see him again in my life. I had not made 3 steps into the outer office when I heard behind my back a gruff, loud, authoritative voice, the voice of our deputy Neptune. It was addressing the head shipping master who, having let me in, had, apparently, remained hovering in the middle distance ever since Mr. R. let the harbor launch have steam up to take the captain here on board the Melita at 9:30 tonight. I was amazed at the startled alacrity of our "Yes, sir." He ran before me out on the landing. My new dignity sat, yet so lightly on me, that I was not aware that it was I, the captain, the object of this last graciousness. It seemed as if all of a sudden a pair of wings had grown on my shoulders. I merely skimmed along the polished floor. But R was impressed. "I say," he exclaimed on the landing, while the Malay crew of the steam launch standing by looked stonily at the man for whom they were going to be kept on duty so late, away from their gambling, from their girls, or their pure domestic joys. "Say, his own launch. What have you done to him?" His stare was full of respectful curiosity. I was quite confounded. Was it for me? I hadn't the slightest notion, I stammered out. He nodded many times. "S. And the last person who had it before you was a duke. So, there." I think he expected me to faint on the spot. But I was in too much of a hurry for emotional displays. My feelings were already in such a whirl that this staggering information did not seem to make the slightest difference. It merely fell into the seething cauldron of my brain, and I carried it off with me after a short, but effusive passage of leave-taking with R, the favor of the great throws an aureole round the fortunate object of its selection. That excellent man inquired whether he could do anything for me. He had known me only by sight, and he was well aware he would never see me again. I was, in common with the other seamen of the port, merely a subject for official writing, filling up of forms with all the artificial superiority of a man of pen and ink to the men who grapple with realities outside the consecrated walls of official buildings. What ghosts we must have been to him. Mere symbols to juggle with in books and heavy registers, without brains and muscles and perplexities. Something hardly useful and decidedly inferior. And he, the office hours being over, wanted to know if he could be of any use to me. I ought, properly speaking, I ought to have been moved to tears. But I did not even think of it. It was merely another miraculous manifestation of that day of miracles. I parted from him, as if he were a mere symbol. I floated down the staircase. I floated out of the official and imposing portal. I went on floating along. I use that word, rather than the word loop, because I have a distinct impression that, though uplifted by my aroused youth, my movements were deliberate enough. To that mixed white, brown, and yellow portion of mankind, out abroad on their own affairs, I presented the appearance of a man walking rather sedately. And nothing in the way of abstraction could have equaled my deep detachment from the forms and colors of this world. It was, as it were, final. And yet, suddenly, I recognized Hamilton. I recognized him without effort, without a shock, without a start. There he was, strolling toward the harbor office with his stiff, arrogant dignity. His red face made him noticeable at a distance. It flamed, over there, on the shady side of the street. He had perceived me too. Something, unconscious exuberance of spirits perhaps, moved me to wave my hand to him elaborately. This lapse from good taste happened, before I was aware that I was capable of it. The impact of my impudence stopped him short, much as a bullet might have done. I verily believe he staggered, though as far as I could see he didn't actually fall. I had gone past in a moment, and did not turn my head. I had forgotten his existence. The next 10 minutes might have been 10 seconds, or 10 centuries for all my consciousness had to do with it. People might have been falling dead around me, houses crumbling, guns firing, I wouldn't have known. I was thinking, colon by Jove. I have got it. It being the command. It. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.